This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. Welcome back. This is hour number two of the show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frayne is at the controls this morning. Well, when he was talking about what he'd like to do with his second term, President Bush said one of the things that was high on the agenda was tort reform. The president has said more than once, and as recently here in Illinois as last March when he was making a speech about it here in the state of Illinois, the president has said that he felt that the country's medical liability system was broken. And as I said, he's been saying this for some time, and certainly there are members of Congress that do agree. He says, basically, the problem is we have greedy lawyers that are filing frivolous lawsuits and runaway juries awarding huge damages to people who claim injuries. And the result, he says, doctors have to pay very high premiums for their malpractice insurance, and sometimes they're paying out large sums to settle lawsuits out of court. The president says it all comes back to consumers in the form of higher costs for health care. So the question, one question at least we want to try and talk a little bit about this morning is this: is there a malpractice insurance crisis? And is the reason that the premiums that doctors have to pay so high, and indeed they are high, you can't get around that, does it have something to do with a lot of lawsuits and big damage awards being handed out? In this part of the program, we'll be talking with David Hyman. He's professor of law here at the University of Illinois College of Law, thought to be one of the country's top health law scholars. He's written on a wide range of subjects, including medical malpractice, also managed care and consumer protection. He served for 3 years as special counsel to the Federal Trade Commission and has taught at some other places as well, including University of Texas and George Washington University Schools of Law, and also at University of Maryland. He's here with us in the studio, and one of the reasons that he's here is that he and some other academics took a look at this very question. At least they picked one state where there was good data, and that happened to be the state of Texas. And they tried to answer that question. Well, what exactly is the relationship between malpractice and lawsuits and the cost of health care and the cost of malpractice insurance? And we'll talk about what it is that they found. And, of course, questions are welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you for having me, David.
This is apparently it is a difficult question to research, because from one state to the next, you don't have the data actually to look at the question. And part of the reason, I guess, that you chose the state of Texas was it's a big state, and some people thought that there was a problem and there was good data so that you could actually look over a long period of time, look at suits that came to some conclusion and try to ask that question, well, okay, what's happening? How many are there? What do the judgments look like, and so forth?
Yeah, that's exactly right. The difficulty with studying this subject is that it's very hard to get comprehensive data, comprehensive in the sense of all claims that were brought. If you actually look, the number of cases that get tried to a jury or a judge is actually very small. In Texas, for example, over the 16 years that we looked at, only about 2% of closed claims were closed after a trial. So that means 98% of the claims that resulted in payment never saw the inside of a courtroom, at least not a completed trial, where a jury said, here's how much you owe. If you look at dollars instead of claims, 95% of the dollars flow through voluntary settlements rather than through trials. And so if you're just focusing on jury verdicts, you get a very distorted impression, particularly because there's no comprehensive source of jury verdicts. Instead, we get newspaper reports of typically big verdicts, and that tends to skew perception. So the first challenge is to find a source of comprehensive closed claims data. And there are only two states that have publicly available databases of all closed claims. That's Florida and Texas. We studied Texas. Another team based at Duke University studied the Florida closed claims data set. And finally, there's what's called the National Practitioner Data Bank, which is a slightly different database, not as comprehensive in some important respects. That covers nationwide, but there are difficulties with using it for the kind of study that we did. A different team of authors has used it, and I think quite effectively. And the interesting thing to us, given our expectations going in, is a remarkable degree of consistency across all of the studies that have been performed, which indicate that popular perception that, as you outlined quite nicely, out of control juries, dramatic increase in the number of claims, dramatic increase in the cost per claim, just isn't borne out by the data.
Yeah. Well, let's
and we can take those, you know, individually.
Let's do that because I think it's quite interesting. So you looked at all of the resolved claims, most of them having been settled out of court, never having gone to trial, between 1988 and 2002. And basically, you found that if you look at the first, let's say, of the large paid claims, the big ones, you looked at that over time, you found that, roughly speaking, the numbers didn't change over that period from 88 to 2002.
Yeah, the title of the paper that you're referring to is Stability, Not Crisis, and I think that actually captures what we found. And you need to look separately at, first of all, the number of claims and then the dollars per claim.
Right.
And we've since updated the results to include 2003, so we've got, you know, 1988 through 2003. So the first question is, well, how many claims are there and are they changing over time? And again, our focus is paid claims because we'll talk more about unpaid claims later, I expect. But paid claims are the ones that attract a lot of attention. So what we find is if you just look at raw numbers over time, you actually see a modest increase in the number of paid claims per year. But there's a problem with just looking at raw numbers because the population of the state of Texas goes up over time. More people receiving more medical care is likely to give rise to more claims. And so you have to control for population. That's one important thing to control for. Mm-hmm. The second thing to control for is how much money we're spending on health care. And why is that? Because more intense medical services are more likely to lead to malpractice, which is likely to lead to more claims. And what we found is whether you control for population increase or you control for number of doctors per population, or you control for medical spending, it turns out that actually the number of claims is flat. There's no increase in claims over time after you control for things that you really need to do to make sense of what's going on. So the number of claims, paid claims, turns out to be quite stable. Then we looked at payments per claim. And an important part of doing this is to control for inflation, because inflation increases the amount that's paid, but it doesn't really reflect a real increase in the dollars per claim. It's just overall economy-wide inflation. And what we found again was a remarkable degree of stability after you control for inflation in the dollars per paid claim, whether you looked at the mean or the median. So overall, the amount of money that we're spending over this 16-year period, 1988 through 2003, per year as a result of payouts for medical malpractice doesn't really seem to be moving very much. The only thing that we found that was going up, which was surprising to us, was defense costs. The cost of defending these claims was actually going up by about 4% a year, and that was a statistically significant finding. And that's, you know, a real increase, but because defense costs are only about 15% of the total cost to including the cost of paying the claims, it wasn't nearly big enough to drive the kinds of spikes that we saw in malpractice premiums in Texas starting in the late 1990s.
Yeah. And I think also, didn't you also look at I think you also looked at the fees that attorneys received. It gets us this greedy lawyer business, and I think that also you found that there wasn't any kind of a big windfall, that somehow lawyers were raking in all of this money as a result of.
Well, we couldn't look at the amount that the plaintiff's lawyers were paid because there wasn't reporting of that. What we had reports of was defense costs.
Okay.
And, you know, I don't know what to make of the claim that greedy lawyers were involved. You know, in order for there to be a lawyer involved on both sides, they need to be paid. Otherwise, they'll find something else to do. And it's hard to see why they would have become significantly more greedy right around the end of 1999 in a way that caused the very dramatic premium increases that we did see in Texas and in other states. And I want to emphasize those are real premium increases. They imposed a lot of stress on physicians and physician practices. I mean, the sort of closest analogy, I guess, would be looking at gas. If it went to $4 a gallon and you drove a truck for a living, that would obviously have a very big impact on your life in quite the same way that a physician facing a 50 or even higher percentage increase in his malpractice premiums would feel under significant stress.
Yeah. Oh, that's, I think here that's an important bottom line for people to understand. We're not saying that there's no problem with what it costs to have malpractice insurance, because clearly there is a problem. And here in this particular state, the rates went up very, very significantly. But in answering the question, why did those rates go up, you can't pin that on what you usually put the finger on, and that is lots of malpractice lawsuits and lots of big judgments being handed down, because apparently that's whatever it is that's driving the cost of malpractice insurance. That's not it.
Yeah, I think that's a very important point. It's very important to keep in mind we have a couple of separate things going that we want to know the answers to, right? Mm-hmm. The first is, if we're trying to decide what to do about dramatic increases in malpractice premiums, it's very important to know why they occurred. Okay, as you know, my medical school professors used to say to me, diagnosis should always precede treatment. And if you've got the wrong diagnosis, you're likely to result in the wrong treatment. So grossly speaking, the explanations are tort-based explanations, more claims or more dollars per claim or both, or insurance explanations, and we can talk about that later as well. And I think what our results indicate is it's very hard to make the case that there are tort-based explanations for the dramatic increase in premiums. So that's mm-hmm. the first issue. The second issue, though, is assessing the merits of the tort system is not limited to simply asking are premiums affordable or not. You want to ask a whole bunch of questions. You want to say, how often are people injured, and how often do they bring tort suits, and how often do they get paid, because we have a tort system in order to pay people who are negligently injured. And you want to know how often people who aren't negligently injured get paid. And you want to know whether the tort system is adequately compensating injured patients, not overcompensating them, not undercompensating them. And you want to know whether it's doing a good job or a bad job of deterring negligent treatment. And you want to know how much it costs and how long it takes. And there are lots of reasons for thinking the tort system doesn't do such a great job along most of those dimensions. So I certainly don't want to leave mm-hmm. listeners with the impression that things are working all that great on the tort side. It's just in the narrow sense of asking, was the tort system driving an increase in premiums? We just don't find particularly good evidence of that in Texas over, you know, a very extended period. And other teams found similar lack of evidence for first Florida and then the nation as a whole.
Yeah. Let me reintroduce our guest here, David Hyman. He's professor of law here at the University of Illinois. His particular area of interest is health law. He's written on medical malpractice, managed care, consumer protection, and he is, in fact, both a JD and an MD. He's one of these classic overachievers that got both of those degrees. I don't know how people do that, but I congratulate you on being able to achieve that.
Thank you. I should mention, just because my dean will kill me if I don't, I'm also jointly appointed in the School of Medicine and the Department Institute for Government and Public Affairs here at the University of Illinois.
Have you ever practiced?
Not practiced medicine. You have to do a residency to do that.
Okay. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And we're talking about some of the issues around malpractice lawsuits, the cost of malpractice insurance, and feeling that some people have that there is a problem and it needs to be addressed legislatively. So just again, so people understand you, because there were at least these two states where there was good data available in Florida, and you and your colleagues looked at Texas, some other people looked at Florida, and basically came up with that same conclusion that if the cost of malpractice insurance is going up, it's not because there's been a dramatic increase in the number of lawsuits. There has not been a dramatic increase in the damages that are paid out. So whatever else is going on, that's not it. And then there, you also feel that there is enough other data so that you can say it's not only do we know that that's not really the reason that's gone up in Florida or Texas, that's probably not the reason that's gone up anyplace.
Well, I'm hesitant to draw that strong a conclusion. It's certainly possible that, you know, as I tell people when I present these results, your mileage may vary. So it's possible that there are states that have, you know, an increase in claims or significant increase in dollars per claim, and that that's an important part of what's driving the premium increases. But that emphasizes the importance of looking, you know, state by state and locally. Mm-hmm. In order to assess this. It's also possible that you won't see state variation, but you may see variation depending on type of specialty. So some specialties may be facing a dramatic increase in number of claims depending on what's going on in that particular specialty. When you look at a state level, it can mask individual variation. Mm-hmm. But it nonetheless calls for caution, particularly with thinking about national solutions when there's when everywhere we look, we don't find these results, or these results are certainly not what we would have expected to find. And let me just mention, Illinois has a database, has maintained a database similar to Texas's database since about 1980. But the problem is that information, because of the legislation that set it up, is not available to outside researchers. The Illinois reform legislation that got signed last year said, going forward, we're going to make that information available. But all of the historical information is not available.
Well, I'm interested in whatever you might be able to say about the state of Illinois. And I know before we got going, you said that, there's – you certainly don't have the same kind of data available. But certainly some people have said Illinois is a place where there is this problem. And in fact – last year, about a year ago, the governor signed into law a legislative effort to deal with this that did things like put a cap on the pain and suffering kind of damages, non-economic
damages.
And also did some other things as well. I think that it put some limits on how much insurance companies can actually raise rates. It capped non-economic damages. That it had to provide for some greater oversight of physicians in their practice. So I think part of the idea behind crafting that legislation was that all of the interested parties, there was something about it for everybody not to like and something about it for everybody to like. So it was supposed to kind of balance the interests. And here in the state of Illinois, particularly, there was this perception that there was a problem and that it was such a problem that it was forcing physicians to leave the state. They were saying, I just can't afford to practice here. And I think, as you suggest, particular kinds of specialties like obstetrics, for example, their physicians who work in that area were saying, the premiums are so high that I can't just practice here. So, and there also, I guess, was a question about that because previous efforts at doing capping damages like this had been struck down by the Illinois State Supreme Court. So I'm not quite sure where this is now. Has this been in effect long enough, or do you have any kind of data so you can say anything about what's going on in the state of Illinois?
Well, let me come back to that, but first talk about Texas because it's striking the similarities.
Sure.
Okay. Texas enacted legislation that's fairly similar in broad strokes to what Illinois did back in 2003, and it did it in response to the same kinds of complaints and concerns that we've been hearing in Illinois for several years, which you just mentioned. But we find there wasn't any of that going on in Texas. So the basic, you know, caution I would make is, you know, in God we trust, all others should bring data to prove what's going on. So the fact that people were complaining about this in Illinois, they were making the same complaints in Texas. So that's just the first sort of important caution in responding to the complaints of people from all sides of this particular debate. I'm not suggesting either side has a monopoly on virtue or anything else for that matter. Okay, so now let's talk about Illinois. Illinois, as you noted, enacted a fairly broad set of legislation. It includes a whole bunch of things. The cap on non-economic damages, which people often refer to as pain and suffering, is $500,000 per defendant, $1 million per hospital. So if you have multiple defendants, you have a higher cap that's potentially available. The cap's not indexed for inflation. In terms of how likely is this cap going to be to dramatically control premiums? Well, I don't expect it to be tremendously effective for a couple of reasons. First is the number of cases that go to verdict is, as I said previously, small, and you only get non-economic damages after you go to verdict. So that's part one. Now, it'll obviously affect the dynamics for negotiating all of the cases that are settled, but nonetheless, I don't expect it to have a profound impact for cases involving individual physicians, because damages that are dramatically in excess of the non-economic damages cap are actually not all that common. Mm-hmm. It does happen, certainly, and sometimes they're eye-poppingly large. We're in the midst of doing a study in Texas trying to get a handle on how important caps are and were in affecting cases. And what we're finding, interestingly, is that insurance policy limits end up being a more significant constraint. That is, if the jury awards more than the defendant has in policy limits, it's quite unlikely to end up being paid, and they don't end up going after personal assets either. So I think, non-economic damages will have an effect. I don't think it'll be a huge effect, but it may, calm people down and make them less anxious about what's going on. I think there is some evidence to indicate caps on non-economic damages affect defensive medicine, and we can talk about that a little bit more later. The problem with caps, because I've just talked about their benefits, the problem with caps is that they tend to affect the people who are injured the worst, the greatest. Okay, so if you have a cap of non-economic damages of $500,000 and you have $490,000 in non-economic damages, the cap doesn't affect you in the slightest. If you have $1 million, it cuts your award on that part of your damages in half. Now, keep in mind, you still get your economic damages, but nonetheless, pain and suffering damages are real, and they end up, certainly people are going to be reluctant to walk away from them, and they're, an important dignitary aspect. Now, that said, people don't tend to insure against them, so that would argue that, a system that dramatically overcompensates people is not one we want. But the empirical studies of the tort system actually suggest that it undercompensates people, not overcompensates people. And the bigger your damages, the more that you're undercompensated relative to your true injuries. So the tort system actually, this goes back to a point I made earlier, it doesn't work particularly well. Okay, it's very expensive. It's very slow. It undercompensates people who don't sue at all, which in medical malpractice circles, a lot of people are injured, but relatively few end up suing. It's a sort of striking finding, dramatic under filing. There's also over filing, excuse me, as well. But you see modest overcompensation of the moderately injured, dramatic undercompensation of the significantly injured relative to their true damages. So non-economic damages are a very blunt way of trying to affect premiums whose costs are borne by the people who are most severely injured. Yeah. It's kind of an odd strategy for dealing with that particular problem.
Well, there are several other things here I want to ask you about, but just one thing now I'm curious about here. As I mentioned, and I hope I have this straight, here in the state of Illinois, twice before there was a legislature did pass a law capping non-economic damages. In one case, what they tried to do was cap them in, I believe that was just I guess what they tried to do was first was to cap all damages, economic and non-economic, and the Supreme Court said no to that. And then they there was another attempt where they were capping all punitive damages in all civil cases, not just medical malpractice, and the court said no to that one too. And I think that in this thing that the governor signed last year, there were some people looking for an opportunity to challenge this law as well. Is it likely, do you think, here in the state of Illinois that once again there'll be a challenge to this and that the Illinois State Supreme Court will say no to capping damages?
I think it's certain to be challenged. The first case that has non-economic damages that significantly exceed the cap will result in a challenge. I think that, the complication is people who know that the cap applies are going to be reluctant to take cases that have large non-economic damages because, their chances of recovery of those are relatively slim. I won't say none, but they're certainly slim. And so if you have to choose between a case that's got lots of economic damages and a case that's got lots of non-economic damages, you're obviously going to have some preference for the former if the latter is higher risk. But nonetheless, I think there will definitely be a challenge. The question is not whether there'll be a challenge, but whether it will be successful. And I'm a native of Illinois, but I've been away for about 14 years. And so I certainly don't hold myself out as an expert on what the Illinois Supreme Court will do. My sense is that, the more narrowly crafted the legislation is, and the more there's the perception that it was responding to a true crisis in access and availability of medical services, the more likely the court will be to let it stand.
Mm-hmm. We are a little bit past the midpoint here. Our guest is David Hyman. He's a professor of law here at the University of Illinois and also in the med school.
That is correct.
And,
thank you.
We are talking here about malpractice, medical malpractice, which is one of the areas that he's particularly interested in. Generally speaking, he's interested in health law. He's also written about managed care and consumer protection. Questions, welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Just to go back to something that you mentioned a little bit earlier, you talked originally about the study that you were involved in looking at the state of Texas and all of these paid malpractice claims resolved, most of them outside of court in this period between 88 and all up to 2003. You said something about unpaid claims. What exactly does that mean? Does that tell you something interesting?
Yeah, it tells you a couple of interesting things. I think the starting point is to sort of think about this in terms of cases flowing through the system, okay? So people go in to receive medical treatment, and some of them are injured and some of them are not. Actually, thankfully, most of them are not, but some of them, a distressingly high percentage, end up being injured as a result of the medical treatment, and some of those are negligent. And then what you can do is ask, well, how many people file lawsuits or bring claims, and those are not exactly the same thing. And then you can look at what happens as those cases or claims flow through the system. So what you discover is that if you look at people who are negligently injured, roughly 35% of them among the most severely injured end up bringing a lawsuit. Mm-hmm. Okay. The percentages are as low as 2% across all negligent injuries. But the more severely injured people are much more likely to bring injuries, and they're likely to consult the lawyers and try and find out what's going on. And one of the important aspects of the malpractice system is the extent to which it makes it hard for people to address people who are injured because they're afraid of being sued if they tell them what's happened, and afraid of taking actions to correct the quality of care. And we can talk about that more as well. I have another article about that and the extent mm-hmm. to which we know that that's going on. But in any event, the basic point is that a lot of the people who are negligently injured never bring a claim. Okay, so that's the underclaiming problem, if you will, because to the extent we have a tort system to make those people whole, if they don't come in the front door, the tort system can't deal with them. But we also have an overclaiming problem. We have people who aren't negligently injured who initiate claims as well. Okay, and I mean, it's a sort of interesting question as to why we have both of those going on simultaneously. Oftentimes, it appears people initiate lawsuits because they don't know what happened to them or why it happened, and the only way they can get answers is to go and consult a malpractice attorney who then makes a request for records, which can result in a claim file being opened, or sometimes just initiates a lawsuit. So you do see overclaiming in the sense of people who aren't negligently injured bringing lawsuits, and you see underclaiming people who are negligently injured not bringing lawsuits. Now, there's a recent study in the New England Journal of Medicine that looks at a bunch of claim files of five different insurance companies, and what they find is that, you know, a really quite impressive number of claims are brought by people who aren't negligently injured. And then the question is, well, how many end up being paid and how many end up not being paid on each of those two categories? It turns out we pay 75% of the time in this particular study. People who are negligently injured get payment, and 25% of those who are negligently injured don't get payment. That answers one question. Okay, and then that's not a particularly impressive performance. You know, 25% of the time when you're entitled to something, you don't get it, you might be a little bit unhappy. And then you say, okay, what happens over on the other side of the equation? What happens to the non-negligently injured who file claims? And it turns out there 75% of the time they don't get paid. So we've got the right result 75% of the time on both sides of the equation. But the wrong result 25% of the times, and that's a problem as well. But if you ask a slightly different question, which is how much money goes to the sort of core cases where we, you know, everybody agrees that they're entitled to compensation, it turns out that's about 86% of the money. Okay, so only 84%. Only about 16% of the money goes to these disputed cases where it's hard to figure out whether they're entitled to it or not. And what that should tell you is that, you know, cases that people call them frivolous, that actually has a technical meaning I don't like to use, but we can just talk about easy cases and hard cases. The easy cases are getting the easy in the sense of everybody agrees that they ought to be compensated, are getting significantly lion's share of the money, and trying to drive the hard cases out of the system. We can do it, but that's not where most of the money is. And then the last point is to ask, well, you know, how much are we spending to run this system? And it turns out it's very expensive to run the tort system. About, again, from this same study, more than 50% of the money is spent on administering the system, paying the lawyers on both sides, paying the insurance companies, administrative expenses, paying court costs, and so on. That's much higher than the cost of running a first-party compensation system or even a system like the disability system that the Social Security Administration runs. And the reasons for that is, you know, these are contested cases where both sides disagree as to strongly as to what happened and who's responsible. Both sides hire experts. They take a lot of time. They take a lot of expertise. So it's not like the money's, you know, being stolen by anybody. It's expensive to hire all of this talent to run the system, but it's important to, you know, say, is this really how we want to spend our money?
Yeah. Let's talk with some people who are listening here. Let's go to an Urbana caller first. They're first in line. Line number one. Hello.
Good morning. You used the term defensive medicine a few minutes ago, and I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that in the field of obstetrics in particular. I've given birth a couple times in the last few years, and the first time was a very highly managed birth where it seemed like one intervention led to the next, and everything was always, they were always trying to prevent something. You know, it was just very intervention heavy. The second child I had at home, and everything just went perfectly, and I have always felt that some of the interventions that were done in my older child's birth were done because the OB was just afraid of being sued or, you know, always making sure to cover her bases. And in reading the birth report afterwards, it also seemed that way. So I wondered if you could comment a little bit about that, and I will listen offline.
Sure. Well, thank you for that question. I was hoping we were going to get back to defensive medicine.
Yeah.
Let me talk about it generally and then talk in specifics about the caller's question. Defensive medicine is the phrase that people use when they refer to things that physicians do because of the risk of tort liability that they wouldn't do otherwise. That's the sort of most general description. And you can think about that in two different ways. Either they do things that they wouldn't do otherwise, or they stop doing things that they would do otherwise. So doing things they do otherwise is running more tests, more imaging studies, getting an additional consult, things like that. Not doing things means that they restrict the scope of their practice. So if you have a family physician who says, I'm just not going to deliver babies anymore, that's a form of defensive medicine as well. Someone who retires or moves across state lines, that's a form of defensive medicine as well. And you can think about it, systematically along those dimensions. So first important point is not all defensive medicine is bad. The point of malpractice liability is to force people to bear the costs of the negligent decisions they make. And, if their response is to be more careful, some of that we think is a good thing, right? Just like if you think about a world in which when people get traffic tickets for speeding, they complain that they can't speed anymore. That's a form of defensive practice as well. But nobody seems to think that it's a bad form. We want, we don't want people driving 100 miles an hour down Windsor Avenue. And we depend on tickets to impose costs on them for doing that. So some aspects of defensive response we actually want to encourage. The challenge is to figure out what's the stuff that's a complete waste that they're doing because they think it makes them safer, because it'll make them look more careful if the case ever comes to trial, and differentiating that from, good defensive medicine from bad defensive medicine is a very hard thing to do. It's hard to see a lot of the reforms that people are excited about doing it. A cap on non-economic damages doesn't encourage good defensive medicine and discourage bad defensive medicine. In some ways, it's hard to see it actually having much of any effect, although there is some research suggesting that it does for reasons that are complex. But in any event, so defensive medicine is, not a straightforward issue. Studies of it, it's been studied for probably 20-some years at this point. It's proven hard to get good data on it. The more recent studies are much better than the earlier ones. And, originally I was quite skeptical that we were going to be able to quantify it. I think the more recent studies have done a much better job on that and have suggested that, we're looking at 2%, maybe as high as 5%, probably not significantly north of that, of medical spending may be attributable to defensive medicine. But how much of that is good defensive medicine versus bad defensive medicine is a different question. Okay, so I think it is a real issue. It's an issue that's going to have, I think, disproportionate effects depending upon where it is you are. So if you've got real access problems, defensive medicine, retirements, moving across state lines are only going to make those worse. In Chicago, it's not likely to have nearly as big effect as it will in rural counties in southern Illinois. Now, finally, to the caller's question, after the sort of long and boring explanation of defensive medicine, you can tell why I'm in academics. I think you certainly hear this sort of thing quite commonly, that people describe it as a clinical cascade where each, test result leads to an additional study, which leads to an additional study, which leads to an intervention, which leads to, you can sort of go on, and the price balloons. Now, the fact that you didn't have a lot of these studies or interventions done when you were at home had a lot to do with the fact that there wasn't any way to do any of them at home, and so you'd sort of opted out of that entirely. And thank goodness things worked out fine, but, the challenge is if they had not worked out fine, you worry about second-guessing yourself along both dimensions. You went to the hospital and everything worked out, thank goodness, but you did have a lot of these interventions. And the challenge is how do you create incentives for, and it's not just for delivering babies, it's more broadly for people to do things that they think make sense from a professional perspective. So how do we get good defensive medicine practiced rather than bad defensive medicine? I don't think there's, you know, straightforward answers to that. I think one interesting strategy is to use guidelines for treatment and to enforce them through the tort system. That is, if as long as you follow the guidelines and you get sued, the case should be dismissed right away. So let me give you a very concrete example of that. There's, you know, I think very solid research indicating that except in very unusual circumstances, cerebral palsy is not attributable to birth injury. And so those cases shouldn't be in the tort system. Those are each of those cases is a tragedy. But it's not a tragedy that's caused by almost all of the time the actions of the obstetrician. And so we shouldn't be using the tort system to try and address that very real problem.
Let us take another caller. This is someone in Indiana, line 4. Hello.
Hello. At least anecdotally, I know in the criminal justice system that oftentimes adversaries, quote unquote, get together with the judge, even decisions about which way this case is going or what can't be done and what will be done. I was wondering if that's anything that happens in the malpractice suits to any extent at all. Thanks a lot.
I'm not quite sure I got the question. It sounded like the issue was whether the lawyers and the judge got together to decide how the case ought to come out.
Or maybe how things would proceed. I'm not sure. Just as I heard it, the caller was saying, you know, we think of the fact that I would think of this as being an adversary kind of system, but that there are times when the lawyers and judges get together and sort of say, okay, how can we get things worked out? Does that happen in cases of medical malpractice?
Well, let's remember that most cases settle. In fact, we couldn't have a system in which most cases were tried for medical malpractice or for criminal justice or for civil litigation, you know, universally. So the fact that, you know, the judge calls the lawyers in and sort of beats their heads against one another and says, look, this there's an old saying, which is a good settlement is always better than a bad verdict, or almost any settlement is better than a verdict, because both parties get what they want out of a settlement. Otherwise, they wouldn't have agreed to it. Mm-hmm. So the fact that the parties settle is not a sign of failure. It's in some ways a trial. There's a famous article, a trial is a failure, which it is, because the parties couldn't figure it out for themselves. And it turns out a lot of the time the parties are using the legal system to figure out liability. They already know what the damages are. They've got a pretty good idea of what the damages are likely to be. They just can't come to an agreement on whether the defendant is liable or not. So without, you know, speaking directly to the context you address, the fact that parties settle and settle most of the time really shouldn't bother us. We ought to encourage it.
And does that – I guess the implication is that maybe somehow that the plaintiff would somehow perhaps be shortchanged.
Well, relative to what would be at least one question. I think, you know, the plaintiff is never going to be made whole. There's a common perception that, people are playing the tort system lottery.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
If you ask most people, they'd rather not play. They'd rather not be negligently injured. Okay. Because remember the sort of statistics I gave you. Most people who are negligently injured, you know, don't start a lawsuit or a claim. And they would... There have been some nice studies that looked at what are the predictors of getting people to sue. And it turns out, you need to suffer reasonably significant injury and you need to be treated poorly by the healthcare system. Poorly in the sense of you're not given answers, you're brushed off. The interpersonal skills are an important part of whether an individual physician gets sued or not. That's not necessarily a good thing, right? We certainly want people to treat their patients well, but we shouldn't want a system in which a bad physician doesn't get sued because he's nice to his patients.
Mm-hmm. We are coming down to about our last few minutes, and I think I have one more person I want to try to get in here in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi, how are you? Mm-hmm. I was thinking about the system, and it seems to me like there's no transparency on either side. If you have, like, if you had a way to look up a doctor's record, not just litigation or lawsuits, because some of those are probably frivolous, and or, you know, just like you said, a lack of communication. But if you could find out whether the physician is not just the board qualifications or state qualified and all these kinds of, you know, things that they give these physicians, if you could find out some way to determine this doctor has a bad record, a surgical record or whatever. I mean, it doesn't seem to be that there's any sort of public record on that, as if, like, the system itself is flawed. And so you basically, when you go to a physician, you know, for whatever reason, maybe a specialist in this person, you know, as a layman, how do you know what's what? I mean, other than how you feel. So I would think that somehow the system itself, you could also say that about attorneys too, actually. But I mean, all these professionals, how do you know if you don't have transparency in you know, on their record? How do you know who you're seeing is qualified? So thus, you got to be messed up by this person. Let's say surgical incompetence or misdiagnosis or whatever, and then you get sick and die, or get real sick and get worse. What's the outlet? The outlet seems to be just litigation then, or threats of lawsuits and all that kind of stuff. So I don't know. What about that? Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, I think transparency is a very important issue. It's very hard to get information. I certainly agree with the caller about providers of all professional services, and that goes for lawyers, and that goes for doctors, and it goes for carpenters and plumbers and, you know, all sorts of providers of services. And in healthcare, it's also hard to get good information about the cost of those services as well. I don't think there are easy answers to that. I think we could do a lot more for transparency than we're doing currently. I also want to maybe – we haven't explicitly addressed the point, but I did want to mention that, you know, a lot of malpractice is not attributable simply to whether you have a, quote, bad apple doctor. There are systems problems with the delivery of healthcare in this country. And emphasizing the actions of individual providers of services actually and somewhat paradoxically makes it harder to address those systemic quality problems. So those are real problems, and we ought to be concerned about those as well, not just about bad apple doctors.
We're almost at the point where we have to finish, and there's one point, and maybe you can talk about it for a minute. It goes back to this, the way that so many people frame the issue, and I mentioned at the beginning, where the president has said, and I'm sure other people have said, we have a problem here, the system's broken, and it goes back to the greedy lawyers, lawsuits without merit, runaway juries, big awards. What you did, you and your colleagues looked at the state of Texas and state of Florida and said, no, actually, that's not what's going on at all. And there's probably reason to believe that, generally speaking, that's not going on anywhere. So if, in fact, if you look at the data and that's not going on, why is it that we think that it is?
Why is it that we think that we have these problems, or why is it that malpractice premiums went up?
Well, yeah, let's. I'm interested in the perception, in public perception particularly, and maybe that's aided by politicians who have particular agendas. I mean, why is it that we have this public perception that we have this crisis with runaway juries and outrageous awards, and that's driving up the cost by way of malpractice insurance, that's driving up the cost of healthcare?
Well, you're going to have me back if you want me to talk about all of those things. So let me just talk about one of them for 30 seconds, which is, why do people perceive that they're runaway juries? And the reason is that – an important reason is that the media disproportionately covers big verdicts, okay? Yeah. So if I asked you to guess, David, how often do you think when a malpractice case is tried that a physician wins? Just guess.
70% of the time.
That's about right. It's about 75% of the time. Okay, but the wins for individual physicians never make it into the newspaper.
Sure.
The ones that do are the multi-million dollar cases. Okay, with staggeringly large damages, you know, brain damaged babies and things. Really horrible cases tend to be the ones that get very, very large damages, because you've got lifetime medical care for those people. So you basically get your perception skewed by unrepresentative cases being emphasized, which is what the media does.
Yeah. All right. Well, we're almost at the point where we have to finish. You said you'd just like to mention real quick, you have a book that will be coming out that looks at Medicare. Maybe we'll have to talk about that another day. You want to just mention real quick?
I just have a book coming out in about 6 weeks called Medicare Meets Mephistopheles, and hopefully I'll be back to talk about that.
Well, we can do that on another day. With more to be said on this topic and others, we want to say thanks to our guest, David Hyman. He's professor of law and medicine at the University of Illinois. Thank you very much.
Thank you.